Well, as they say, try and follow that. I'm not sure if I'll be quite as exciting as that, but we'll do our best. Can I just say, for those who get Tanya's prayer letter, there are some of your own, if you get the personal copies, they're in the pigeonholes, the latest edition. The other thing I should say is that I prepared my message from the ESV, so if it's a little bit different in some of the names, you'll understand why. Now, one of the things that I used to like doing was playing chess. And I used to play chess with a friend of mine called Alan Howson. We don't get together for chess quite as much. Now, if you know about chess, you know that you've got all these different character rounds. You've got a king and a queen, you've got bishops, and you've got knights, and you've got rooks, and you've got pawns. And not prawns, pawns. And sometimes you can find that a pawn can be a very valuable piece on the board, although it seems insignificant. The queen is the most powerful, and the idea is that they're going to defend their own king and also to attack the king on the other side. And the idea is to put the king into checkmate so they can't move and you've won the game. Now, as I look at this chapter of Esther, it seems to me it's like God's chess game, and God is the grand chess master. And when you look at this, you see all these different moves, and you see people making moves, and this is one of the great things about chess. If you're really good at it, I think I was getting to be able to plan maybe three moves ahead. But if you're really good, you can plan about five or six or seven or whatever, and you can get a guy to move his pieces where you want him to be, and he thinks he's done great. He's going to take your queen, or he's going to take a bishop, and he thinks he's done marvellous. And before he knows where he is, he's lost about six of his pieces and he's in check. And this is what we've got here. So these are the players. We've got the king, and I call him Ahasuerus, which is the Hebrew name for the Persian name, Kshasa, while Xerxes is the Greek name. So that's why he's got these two names. And the book of Esther covers the Persian period of history. So Ahasuerus, he reigned from 486 to 465 BC. And there's also two queens, which there always is on a board. One's a black queen, one's a white queen. And we've got Queen Vashti, and we've got Queen Esther. And then we've got these other important pieces, Haman, and we've got the eunuchs, we've got Mordecai. And the whole story to me underlines the providence of God in the affairs of men. That is, God is in control. And of course, we've also got the wise men. I don't know whether we put them as pawns or not. They're the seven princes of Persia. And the whole story is about two plots and a number of choices. So, as we start in chapter 2, 19 to 23, we see a plot discovered. And it would appear that even though King Ahasuerus had made Esther his queen, he quite kind of liked this idea that had been dreamt up. So he decides to build up his harem, and he has more beautiful virgins come before him. And we saw last week of how Mordecai was bringing up Esther, who was the daughter of Mordecai's uncle. And she was a beautiful girl in appearance, as well as in nature. And she'd been summoned to the palace and had caught the eye of the king. So she pleased him so much that she was made queen in Vashti's place. And so we saw Richard as Mordecai there, sitting at the king's gate. And the king's gate in an ancient city was its major commercial and legal centre. Markets were held there, and the court sat there to transact their business. And the king might have an audience at the gate and make decisions on matters regarding the state and individuals. And we read about this in Samuel 2, Samuel 19, and 1 Kings. We see that the king David comes down to the gate. So the fact that Mordecai was sitting at the gate would confirm or would seem to indicate that he held some kind of high position in the service of the empire. Possibly this was because of his connection with Esther. And then we read in verse 20 that Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded. Now it kind of raises a number of questions, this. So why had Esther not revealed? Was she just totally obedient to Mordecai, or was there underlying reasons? Well, was she ashamed that she was a Jew? Was she afraid to say that she was a Jewess? Well, we don't know if that was the case, but we know that she did follow Mordecai's instructions. And the book of Esther doesn't record everything about Esther and Mordecai, but there might have been a deeper faith there that is apparent in this passage. So the Jewish festivals, which provided a structure for worship, had been lost by the time of Esther, and they'd lost the Passover by the time of 2 Kings chapter 3, and Pentecost had been lost by Nehemiah chapter 8. So maybe some of the structure of worship had kind of been disintegrated a little bit, or not quite as strong. It may have been that there was an obvious, to the Jews anyway, was an undercurrent of anti-Jewish sentiment in the land. Or it might have just been that the intervention of Haman might have held by other people in the court, and it would have been a dangerous thing to do, and there was fear of retribution. But Esther kept quiet about her Jewish faith. And as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, as we saw in our play, became angry and plotted to kill King Ahasuerus. Now, we don't know why they were angry. It's been conjectured that maybe they once held an important position in Vashti's court when she was queen, and now they sought to depose of the king on her behalf. We really don't know. But just like King Ahasuerus, they were angry, and because of this, they made unwise decisions. And here was a choice for them, wasn't it? The choice was to serve the king or to kill him. And they made that choice that they were going to kill him. And they must have known that if the plot had failed, that they would die. Or even if the plot was discovered. And then Mordecai hears of this, and he too has a choice to tell or not to tell. So what are the consequences, depending what move he makes? If he doesn't tell and the king gets killed, is that a good thing for his queen, for Esther? Or will that be a bad move? Because if a new king comes in, will he, like the kings of those days, decide to destroy anybody that had anything to do with the power base of the old king? So would he be putting Esther's life in forfeit if he allowed this to go forward? Or would it be good for him to get rid of a king who was making bad decrees? So he makes his decision, and he seems to have a means of contacting Esther, and he tells about the plot, and Esther's granted an audience with King Ahasuerus, and she tells the king and Mordecai had overheard a plot by the two eunuchs to kill him. So it's interesting to see here what King Ahasuerus does. He doesn't just take Mordecai's word for it, but he investigates the matter and finds it true. And I think there's an important principle here. Quite often we hear things, and we hear things about people, or people tell us things about other people or whatever, or what's happening to them. And we can be so taken up to take one side of the story that we just listen to them. And we don't hear what's the other side of the story. And we make our judgments on just one thing we hear, on hearsay or one story. So it's always good to investigate and to hear the other side of the story to to find out if we've got all of the facts before we make our decisions. So, King Ahasuerus, he investigates, he seems to find that the matter is true, and both men are executed. And what seems to be an insignificant sentence in verse 23 becomes critical to the events in the story. As we saw, it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So here's one of these chess moves that seems pretty relevant. Why did he make that move? But later on, we'll see that it becomes an important part of God's plot and God's move. So it was an unusual event, mind you, this keeping a record. It's of a significant event in King's reigns. We read about it in 1 Kings 14:29, when we read that the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did were written in the Chronicles of the King of Judah. And we find this is happens throughout the Chronicles. In fact, we have two books of the Chronicles. So that's the first plot. And then in chapter 3 we see a plot is hatched. It's been 4 years since Esther's been selected as queen. And after these things we read that King Ahasuerus promoted Mordecai the Jew and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Wrong. We read, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Slight boo there. I mean, it is interesting, and I can't remember if Rob mentioned it last week, but apparently whenever the Jews read the book of Esther, all the children are encouraged to boo at when Haman's name is mentioned even today. So after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agite, the son of Hammedath, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Now onto the scene comes this new piece in God's chess game, Haman. So why he was promoted, we don't know, but he seems to have worked his way into the king's favour. He seems to be the second most powerful man in the kingdom. Perhaps he was a yes man. And as the king's representative and person of honour, it was required of the people to bow before him and acknowledge him, and acknowledge the status which Haman was very proud of, and especially as the king had commanded it. So to do otherwise was to go against the king's orders. So everyone passed down, bowed down as he passed by, or wherever he came into the presence. All that is except Haman. Sorry, Mordecai. Haman couldn't bow down before himself. Well, the king's servants urged Mordecai to bow down, but Mordecai refused. So why did Mordecai refuse to bow down? Well, verse 4 tells us that Mordecai had revealed to them that he was a Jew, and that this is probably why he wouldn't bow down. So again, we see choices. Haman had choices. Mordecai had choices here. He had a choice to reveal that he was a Jew or not reveal he was a Jew. And again, the question is, why did he refuse to reveal he was a Jew before and now he revealed himself as a Jew? We don't really know. But the drama with Haman and Mordecai seems to go back to more than 1,000 years before the events of Esther, where the Jews exited from Egypt and they were attacked by the Amalekites. We read about that in Exodus 17. And their lineage began with Amalek, who was the grandson of Esau. And God promised his curse on the Amalekites, which resulted in their elimination as a people. We read in Exodus 17 and Deuteronomy 25. And in Exodos 17, verse 8 to 14, we read how Amalek comes and he fought at Rephidim in the wilderness journey. And that famous story, as Moses holds up his staff, the Israelites are winning. And they prevailed, and Joshua, who was leading the army, prevailed. And if his arms came down, then the Amalekites, they were the ones in the presidents. And so they held up Moses' arms. And God said that he would blot out the memory of Amalek from generation to generation. And in 1 Samuel 15, verses 2 and 3, God recalls what Amalek had done to Israel in the wilderness, and he commands King Saul to destroy all the people and their livestock, and King Agag and the Amalekites. And Saul did this, he destroyed them all apart from the king, and in the end he was put to the sword by Samuel. So by the time that Esther, 550 years had passed since the death of King Agag. And in spite of such a passage of time, neither Haman the Agite nor Mordecai the Benjamite had forgotten the tribal feud that still smouldered in their souls. And for Mordecai, the choice was easy: honour the king of Persia or honour God. And he honoured God's command. He chose to honour God. So there was the choices. And sometimes it comes as a Christian, a question here, you know, how long do we keep a kind of a grudge? And do we forgive those who wrong us? Mordecai seemed to be stubborn in one respect. He wouldn't bow down to Haman. And because of this, he brought his own people into the conflict. So we find that Haman is now filled with fury. Not only is he being slighted by Mordecai, but he's being slighted by a Jew, a people who had brought about the destruction of his people. So he plots to get his revenge, not only for himself, but for his ancestors. He could have taken his wrath out on Mordecai, but he knew that he was known to the queen, so he plots to annihilate the Jews in the kingdom, which would include Mordecai, in the same manner that the Jews had dealt with his ancestors. Total annihilation. So when would this event occur? How would they decide? Well, they cast lots. It says day after day, month after month, till the 12th month of Adar, which is the month when the Jewish celebration of the Passover took place, where the people of Israel, the Jews, remembered the deliverance of the Israelites from Egypt. And it was the month that Haman begins plotting their destruction. And so he goes to King Ahasuerus and he makes false accusations against the Jews that they don't keep the king's laws. And Haman also offers the king a sum of money to help in his decision. I suppose today we would call that a bribe. And it reminds me of Jesus' false accusations that were made against him, and the fact that a bribe of 30 pieces of silver were paid. But in this case, Haman offers 10,000 talents of silver. And apparently this was about two-thirds of the annual income of the Persian Empire. A lot of money. So where was Haman going to get all this money? Well, the money was probably going to come from the plunder of the Jewish people. And King Ahasuerus is happy to authorize the slaughter of the Jews without making further investigation of the truth of what Haman is saying. So it is interesting, isn't it, that he was willing to investigate when he learns about these eunuchs who were plotting against him, but he takes Haman's word completely without any investigation. And so Ahasuerus gives his signet ring, a symbol of his power and authority, and the deeds in motion. Haman had the royal seal of approval. And an edict is written in the name of the king, with the authority of the king, and letters, as we saw in our player there, were sent to the kingdom to do to the Jews what the Jews had done to Haman's ancestors. The same edict is given that was given by Samuel to King Saul to kill the Amalekites. So the day is fixed for the annihilation of the Jews. And again, we read it was on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, as the Jews were celebrating the Passover in remembrance of their deliverance from Egypt. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. So not all of the citizens of Susa were in agreement with Haman. So what did we learn from the passage this morning? Well, one thing is, don't make decisions when you're angry. King Ahasuerus divorced Vashti when he was angry. The eunuchs plotted to murder the king when they were angry. And Haman plotted genocide when he was angry. And I think one of the things that we have to be careful about is that we make these rash decisions. Decisions that we might later regret. Things that we might say to our friends, our brothers and sisters in Christ, that later we would regret. The second thing is that there was a number of choices that could be made. Mordecai had a choice to make. He could forget the past and move on. He could follow the flow, or he could stick by his principles. But he knew that bowing down to Haman would be dishonouring to God, so he didn't do it. And he even revealed that he was a Jew, whatever the consequences to himself might be. So how about ourselves? Are we willing to stand for Christ, whatever the consequences? We're in a world that's... but we're not of the world, we're told. And because the world hated Christ, we're told that the world will also hate us also. And we're reminded in our break of bread service this morning that we're living in a world which seems very much anti-Christian and anti the principles of God's word and Christ's word himself. And so we have to make choices. And we don't know what the choices will be in the future. It might be a life and death choice. That if you say that you're a Christian, as some of our brothers and sisters abroad are at this present time, that you'll be killed, and your family, for your faith. And the third thing I think we've learned today through this passage is that the divine providence of God plays a big part in the lives of those who love the Lord. Joseph says to his brothers, "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." I wonder, do you see the hand of God in your life? When you look back, are you quite amazed at how the events in your life played out? Just like on that chessboard, as the moves were made, they seem irrelevant at the time, or they might seem painful at the time. But when you look back, you see how amazed how God has been playing his part in your life. Do you recognize God working out his plan in your life? And then I think the fourth thing is we see human responsibility. In chapter 2:20, Esther was obedient to Mordecai. She didn't reveal that she was a Jew. And Mordecai seemed to keep quiet that he was a Jew till chapter 3, verse 4. So how do we deal with those who we come into contact with? Do we tell them that we're Christians? Or do we keep quiet? If Esther had spoken about her faith earlier, would she have been made queen? Or would Haman have prevented her? Would she have influenced the king in the same way? I think one thing is certain, we should never be ashamed to declare that we are Christians. But maybe sometimes in God's plan, we have to choose the right time to declare that we belong to God. We're all part of God's great chess game. But we're not just inanimate objects. It's God's steadfast love for us that He makes out moves in our lives so that we might bring glory to Him and that we might know His presence with us. Just pray that through this week we might be very aware of God leading in our lives just as He did in our characters in our story today.